point and back. Up and down, slow or fast, it matters not. They know every inch of the way, but can't distinguish an egret from a crane. The salt marsh was a place of beauty, yet along much of the road lay junk. Mattresses, rusted barrels, appliances, a drive shaft, tires, a sofa. At one gut full of cans, Miss Alice said, "I've yet to see a bean can sprout. Won't be long for that gut now." She shook her head. "The grave's for people when they've seen enough. But how can you see enough when you're 20? I read in The Sun that kids feel disconnected. How can that be? Connections lying over the land like stardust. They live in the land of Nod." We came to a high piling of rusting automobiles, where a teenager was stripping wheels from a smoldering pickup. "He's found a drowned man with a pocket full of money," she said. "We're a dead end here when it comes to merchandise. There aren't any repair shops on the island, so whatever gets shipped out here stays. We're at the end of the assembly line, and there it is. Not enough space to hide from our junk. You'd think living beside trash we'd do something about it, but all we do is get used to it. We think it's the way of things." "Is the cause poverty?" "We have no poor, except those that choose to be. Those that would be poor as Garbroth anywhere, the ones who work only so they can quit." "No, the cause is education. Not enough of the proper kind at the right time." She told about the organization of the island. No mayor, no jail, no local taxes, no water bill, unless you counted the annual $20 for maintenance of the artesian wells. The water, delicious and cold, has its source in the Blue Ridge Mountains. A natural underground pipeline from Virginia to us. I think it was our good water that finally got us to build a sewage system to replace septic tanks, in the nick of time. We came to Rhodes Point. A single street of watery yards, hung with fishing nets and stacked with chicken wire crab pots. Everywhere lay oyster shells, their pearly interiors gleaming like bits of a broken necklace. We weaved in and out of the yards, and Ms. Alice commented on more sights. A birdbath, supported by three plastic seahorses. "Properly belongs on a wedding cake." A peculiar house with a chimney above the front door. "Do you enter through the fireplace?" And overlooking the bay, an old house with a new picture window on the second floor. "Wouldn't catch me up there in a nor'wester unless you chloroformed me." When we came to a front yard with a stone obelisk in memory of Job A. Evans, who drowned in Tangier Sound, I asked why it wasn't in the cemetery. "It's not rightly a grave. Never found the man. Chesapeake keeps her dead. But the islanders do sometimes dig graves in their yards, because land is at such a premium." Yet next to the old Methodist church, a big wooden building not at all of a size commensurate with the tiny fishing village, was a burial ground of watermen's tombstones carved with bug eyes and skipjacks. Miss Alice stopped at a fresh grave. 15 years old. Sitting in his car one night, made a little sound and fell over dead with dope. Went to his funeral. The young find their drugs even out here. At one empty home, a large telescope house built by Captain Hoffman, we looked in the broken windows. "Never did get my curiosity cured," she said. "Some people sit around and wait for the world to poke them. Right here, in this old curiosity shop of a world, they say, 'Poke me, world.' Well, you have to keep the challenges coming on. Make them up if necessary." At the end of the street, which was also the end of dry ground, the island became a tangle of water and weed, neither solid nor liquid, but a treacherous in-between, running most of the way to Tylerton. On the bay side of Rhodes Point stood crab houses and pounds with shedding floats where peelers were held until they molted. "Once the crab peels, you have to pull him out directly, or the water will start him to hardening again. That is, if another doesn't eat him first, soft morsel that he is for a few hours." Tied up at the pier was the Island Bell, an old skinny wooden boat of quaint lines. Miss Alice said, "Listen to this sentence. The Island Bell, she's a gas boat, she changed our social pattern. Some people wouldn't agree, but it's the truth. She made her first crossing the month I arrived 63 years ago. She's never been underwater, and that's something here. How was it she changed the island? Before the bell, people got to the eastern shore once a year, at Christmas. She brought passage. Regular comings and goings. We got outside, and the outside got in. She ended our isolation. Carried mail and medicine, the sick and dying, brought news, food, gas, firewood, even ideas, I deem. There aren't many places in the country that can point to one thing and say, right there, that's the thing which changed us. That's what made us the way we are now. It's hard to imagine. Imagine what America would look like without the car. Then you'll know what this island would be like without the bell. Now, of course, teenagers ride to high school in Crisfield on the bus boat. I'm not even sure we're an island anymore, unless you spell it capital I-L-A-N-D. Catch the difference? She looked down a narrow cove. Lansex! Toyd's coming in. Let's hoof it back. I'll be getting tired around the knees soon. The walk to Yule was quieter and slower. Miss Alice asked how I came to be in Maryland. I told her, and used Whitman's phrase about gathering the minds of men. She said, "When olden day travelers went about, they might carry something called an album amicorum, to gather the signatures and sentiments of learned men they visited along the way. Is that what you're doing?" I've thought of the trek more as just the bear going over the mountain to see what he could see. At Scud Inn, I stopped to get my duffel so I could catch the afternoon boat to Crisfield. "I have a question for you," I said. "Tell me what's the hardest thing about living on a small marshy island in Chesapeake Bay." "I know that, and it didn't take 63 years to figure it out. Here it is, wrapped up like a parcel. Listen to my sentence. Having the gumption to live different and the sense to let everybody else live different. That's the hardest thing. Hands down." 15. The telescope house may not be indigenous to the eastern shore, but there were more of them here than anywhere else. The name derived from the linking of three houses, each successively larger, so that the two smallest ones look as if they could slide telescope fashion into the largest house. The design came about for economic reasons. A young family built a small two-room home. As the family and income grew, they added a wing of usually four rooms and later another addition of six rooms. Along the back roads north of Crisfield were many of them, most with standing seam metal roofs. On a peninsula between Choptank and Tread Avon Rivers, I came to Oxford, a 17th-century village of brick sidewalks and 19th-century houses. Only a few small streets branched off the main trunk, Robert Morris Street, a way of aesthetically cohesive homes and yards fenced by the Oxford picket, a slat with a design at the top that looks like an ace of clubs with a hole shot in it. The pickets were popular, even though painting the holes could take all spring. At the bottom of Morris Street, across from the Tread Avon ferry slip, sat the Robert Morris Inn, the 1710 portion of which, built by a shipwright, was once the home of Robert Morris, senior and junior, a family of fortune and misfortune. The father died when wadding from a cannon fired in his honor struck him in the arm. The son, one of the wealthiest men in 18th century America and a financier of the Revolution, was sentenced to 3 years in a Philadelphia debtor's prison after a spell of reverses, one of which was the failure of the new government to repay his loan to the Continental Army. Like some of the homes on Morris Street, the inn had fallen into disrepair by the 1940s, after Oxford, a commercial port of entry the equal to Annapolis in the early years, lost its trade and later most of its fishing fleet. But in the last decade or so, people from Baltimore, Washington, and Philadelphia began recognizing the calm and beauty of the little harbor town, and the new bay bridges across the Chesapeake near Annapolis made the eastern shore easily accessible. Newcomers moved in and started renovating the old homes. Now in the boatyards rode motor sailors and sloops and cabin cruisers. In the inn, mail-order catalog yachtsmen and wives leafed through picture books of eastern shore hunting decoys and referred to the old houses as architectural statements. That was the new, old Oxford. But between the inn and the harbor lay an old, old Oxford, a tight cluster of worn houses of the blacks who had spent their lives here. I took the Tredavon ferry, at 3 centuries the oldest operating cable-free ferry in the United States, to Bellevue, and drove out the double-fingered peninsula toward Tilghman Island. On the way was St. Michael's, the town that fooled the British by inventing the blackout. During the War of 1812, word reached the citizens that a night bombardment was imminent. Residents doused all lights, except candles in second-story windows and lanterns they hung in treetops. British gunners misread the lights, miscalculated trajectories, and overshot the town. The trick preserved numerous colonial buildings, including one home where a stray cannonball fell through the roof and bounced down the stairway past the startled lady of the house. By dusk, I was on Tilghman Island, an island only by virtue of a streamlet called Knapp's Narrows. I parked near the wharf where much of the last sail-powered fishing fleet in America tied up. Against the clouding sky, I could make out the tall masts and long bowsprits of the skipjacks, ships that hoist 1,200 feet of sail to pull port and starboard dredges over the oyster rocks. Some people believed the skipjacks were the last of an era, while others held they were, once again, the future. A storm came on, and I ran for ghost dancing. Inside, I listened to the rain beat out a hard, steely number on the roof, not yet ready for sleep. I lay on the bunk to watch the electric night. Black Elk loved thunderstorms because in their swift fire, he heard the great voices. For me, I heard more the Heyokas, those beings of lightning, those dancing human clowns who do things foolishly backwards. In his time on the Blue Road, the immaterialist Black Elk often heard voices from the clouds. In my season on the Blue Highways, the voices I heard were those of men. Men who knew about stumbling not from observation as gods know it, but rather from having stumbled. For that reason, their words carried a force cloud voices could not match. If clouds gave Black Elk his visions, they merely made me wet. But like any man of ordinary cut, I sometimes heard human voices that showed the power not of visions, but of revision. The power to see again and revise. Lightning, flickering in the ghost, flashed the rubbed image of the ancient stone face of redemption or death on the Minuteman's marker into a spectral reflection. Whitman. Can each see signs of the best by a look in the looking glass? Is there nothing greater or more? Does all sit there with you? Something opened. Call it the looking glass syndrome. Like a crazed enemy running amok, ego, that excessive looking inward, had had its way in the Indian Wars, and now the old life with the Cherokee was lost. But what had not been lost was the chance, as Black Elk says, to make over. A man cannot remake ego, because it is able to grow only in size, like a simple cell. A locked form, unable to change its structure, it is ever only what it is. Not so an angle of vision, as the old Jerseyman had called it. That a man could make over. To remake is his potential, his hope. A human being is not a waxen rubbing, a lifeless imprint taken from some great stony face. Rather, he is a minute man or a dog soldier at liberty to use the inclinations of the past as he sees fit. He is free to perceive the matrix and, within his limits, change from it. By seeing both the futility in trying to relive the old life and the danger in trying to obliterate it, man can gain the capacity to make anew. His very form depends not on repetition, but upon variation from old patterns. In response to stress, biological survival requires genetic change. It necessitates a turning away from doomed replication. And what of history? Was it different? Etymology. Educate, from the Latin educare, lead out. Part 10. Westward. 1. Nobody was sure about the figures around here. According to one waterman, of the hundreds of skipjacks once dredging oysters from Chesapeake Bay, about a dozen remained at Tillman Island and perhaps an equal number at Deal Island. Another man thought there might be as many as 40 on the entire bay. Two men said skipjacks were doomed, but another held that expensive fuel would bring them back. He believed the old ships with refinements would become the new ships, and that the diesel boats replacing the skipjacks were the temporary ones. Even though no new skipjacks had been built since 1956, the aging fleet still survived by virtue of a Maryland law designed to prevent overharvesting that allows dredging under motor power only on Mondays and Tuesdays. One other thing made for the survival of that single-masted double-sailed boat of low and majestic lines. People here, now that the bug eyes are gone, consider the skipjack the very symbol of the Eastern Shore. It is to them what the beanpot is to a Bostonian. I went north, crossed Chesapeake Bay, and stopped at the city market down among the 18th-century streets of Annapolis to eat a dozen fresh clams at Hannon's stone counter. For the road I bought a cut of smoked chub, a quart of slaw, and 6 bottles of Black Horse ale. I took Maryland, too, over the hills along the bay, turned west at Prince Frederick, crossed the wide Patuxent River, on through Burnt Store and Allen's Fresh, across the even wider Potomac. I came into Virginia on State 218, an old route now almost forgotten. The towns typically were a general store and a few dispersed houses around a crossroads, Osso, Gobi, Passapatanzi. In Fredericksburg, home of George Washington's brother-in-law, Colonel Fielding Lewis, a cannon manufacturer whom the Episcopalians buried in an honored position under the steps of St. George's Church, Salve Lucrum, I stopped at a U-pump gas station, one of those places where you push your credit card through a slot to the on-duty commandant of the fuel islands. I asked for the air hose. "Ain't got no air," he said. I might as well have gone to a fire plug for service. The age of self-serve. I suffered a reflex of nostalgia. Back in the age of inner tubes, Vernon's service actually sold gasoline and service. Vern wore a little black plastic clip-on bow tie and stub-billed cap that gave him the look of a smudged motorcycle cop. With a faded red wiping rag hanging from his hip pocket, Vern over the years made an oily trail between the pumps and grease pit. He washed windshields with real sponges that he ran through a little wringer kept by the Ethel pump. I think his wife laundered them twice a week. But the men's restroom wasn't any cleaner than now, and there wasn't a hot water faucet then, either. But you didn't need a key to get in. And his mother wouldn't let him install quarter machines vending latex health aids. There were only 2 posted rules at Vernon's, one an old gas station apothegm. "We aim to please. You aim too, please." The other, "No tools loaned," was necessary because people liked Vern and actually asked to borrow his tools. Tools. Vern had no diagnostic equipment other than a good ear and eye, and he could correct a surprising assortment of problems with a screwdriver and adjustable wrench. Even then, Vern was an anachronism. We boys who collected at his station didn't call him that, of course. We called him, as I remember, an old fart. Vern, in his antique ways, believed that anyone who got behind a steering wheel could rightly be expected to operate the car rather than just steer it. That's why you were issued an operator's permit. He believed the more work a driver did, the less the car had to do. The less it had to do, the simpler and more reliable and cheaper to repair it would be. He cursed the increasing complexity of automobile mechanics. But as I say, he was a man of the old ways. He even believed in narrow tires, cheaper and less friction, spoked wheels, less weight, and the streamlined airflow designs of Chrysler Corporation cars of the mid-30s, designs Chrysler almost immediately gave up on before proceeding to build the biggest finned hogs of all. We boys of the 50s loved their brontosaurian bulk. Another of Vernon's themes we laughed at was his advocacy of the comparable economy and safety of three wheels. He drove a motorcycle with a sidecar for city driving. He would say to us, "Two wheels ain't enough, and four is too many. So where does that leave you, boys?" "Three wheels," we'd shout back, mocking him. "No, sir. It leaves money in your jeans." So much for antiquity. I went down to Civil War Spotsylvania for the night. The heavy fighting for control of the important crossroads in front of the Spotsylvania County Courthouse occurred in fields and woods a couple of miles away, and now the intersection linked the bluest of back roads, a crossing of so little economic, logistic, and strategic importance as to make the conflict between Lee and Grant appear imbecilic. The big battlefield outside town is today a National Historic Site marking a series of battles that began at a place called the Wilderness. Atop one hill, with forest behind and open land in front, at a little bend in the breastworks, troops fought what may have been the longest and most savage hand-to-hand combat of the war, the Battle of Bloody Angle. The fighting here in the wet spring of 1864 was so close that cannoneers, standing ankle-deep in mud, fired at point-blank range. Soldiers, slogging it out in a smoky rainstorm, fought muzzle-to-muzzle, stabbing with bayonets, thrusting swords between logs of the parapet, clubbing each other into the mire from dawn to midnight, and trampling fallen men out of sight into the muck. The intense rifle fire cut in half oak trees 2 feet in diameter. One soldier, Horace Porter, wrote, "We had not only shot down an army, but also a forest." On that single day of May 12th, nearly 13,000 men died fighting over 1 square mile of ground, abandoned by both sides several days later. Yet had anyone been paying attention, the battle could have shown the futility of trench warfare, a lesson that would have to be learned again at even higher cost in the First World War. At that bivouac of the dead, as one monument had it, I ate the smoked chub. Across the grassy meadow stood a shaft commemorating the Ohio contingent. Among the carved names, Gasham Arnold, Elam Dye, Lewis Wolfe, Enos Swinehart. Three children raced from under the oaks out over the grass to reenact the battle with guttural gunshots from their boyish throats. They argued briefly about who would be who. One chose the Americans, one the Germans, one the Irish. The small cries of the boys, and the bugs churring out the last of spring, and the warmth of the evening sun, almost turned Bloody Angle to an idyllic meadow. But its history was the difference. Even though Titans and Tridents and MXs have not made the red business, as Whitman called it, a thing of the past, they have eliminated future battlefield parks where boys can play at war, unless scientists find means to hang monuments in the sky. 2. Captain Jack Jewett probably didn't have a chance against the fame of Paul Revere, yet Jewett's deed was comparable. On June 4, 1781, Captain Jack rode his bay mare Sally 40 miles from Cuckoo Tavern to Charlottesville to warn Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and that nest of sedition, the Virginia General Assembly, that Bloody Tarleton's Green Dragons were coming. Jewett rode without stopping, while the British raiders stopped three times, once to burn a wagon train, and thereby lost both the rebels' capture and a chance at dramatic incident. A good thing for American history, and for Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Jewett is a devilish name to rhyme. When I saw Cuckoo, Virginia, it was a historical marker and a few houses at an intersection. I went up U.S. 33 until the rumble of hills became a long, bluish wall across the western sky. On the other side of Stannardsville, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, I stopped in a glen and hiked along Swift Run, a fine rill of whirligigs and shiners, until I found a cool place for lunch. Summer was a few days away, but the heat wasn't. Water striders and riffle bugs cut angles and arcs on smooth backwaters of the stream that reflected cirrus clouds crossing the ridges. They would make West Virginia before I did. I was sitting at the bottom of the eastern side of the Appalachians, When I came out of the mountains again, I would be in the Middle West. $16 in my pocket. The journey was ending. In a season on the Blue Roads, what had I accomplished? I hadn't sailed the Atlantic in a washtub, or crossed the Gobi by goat cart or bicycled to Cape Horn. In my own country, I had gone out, had met, had shared. I had stood as witness. I took a taste of Swift Run, went back to the highway and followed it up Massanutten Mountain. Again, the going was winding and slow. Near sunset, I reached West Virginia and drove on to Franklin, a Main Street hamlet sharing a valley with a small river, as the Appalachian towns do. Above the South Fork, above a hayfield and under the mountains, I pulled in for the night. After a small meal in the Ghost, I marked on a map the wandering circle of my journey. From the heartland out and around. A blue circle, gone beyond itself. Everything the power of the world does is done in a circle, Black Elk says. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing, and always come back again to where they were. The life of a man is a circle, from childhood to childhood, and so it is in everything where power moves. Then I saw a design. There on the map, crudely, was the labyrinth of migration the old Hopis once cut in their desert stone. For me, the migration had been to places and moments of glimpsed clarity. Splendid gifts all. 3. The state seal of West Virginia is not a used tire hanging on a fence post any more than the state flag is a tattered cloth used as an automobile gas tank cap. But well, it could be. Heaped in yards, sliding down hills, hanging from trees and signs, were old tires. It seemed as if West Virginia sat at the bottom of a mountain where Americans came annually to throw away their 200 million used tires. Along Highway 33 lay hardscrabble farms, as the 30s called them, of rocky fields, dwindly crops, houses partly painted in two or three colors, trumpet vine, crawling iron bedstead trellises, and jimson weed, taking warped five-rail fences. Kiss the middle rail to cure chapped lips. In the few places large and level enough for true fields, men were putting up hay by hand. The road, a thing to wrench an eel's spine, went at the mountains in all the ways, up, down, around, over, through, under, between. I've heard, who knows the truth, that if you rolled West Virginia out like a flapjack, it would be as large as Texas. Where possible in the mountainous interruptions, towns opened briefly. Judy Gap, Mouth of Seneca, Elkins. At Buckhannon, I drove southwest on State 4. Beautiful country, despite hills clobbered with broken appliances and automobile fragments, which children turned into jungle gyms. Should you ever go looking for some of the 600 million tons of ferrous scrap rusting away in America, start with West Virginia. Then Sutton, hidden in the slant of mountains at the heart of the state, a town that began in 1805 when John O'Brien took up residence in a hollow sycamore along the Elk River. Now Sutton was an old place of grizzled and maimed men who could have been the last survivors of the Union Army. One missing a right hand, one the left, another with a patched eye, one minus a nose, one an ear. As for limps and bent spines, I couldn't count them all. And the teeth, broken, rotted, snaggled, bucked, splintered. An orthodontist's paradise. But that wasn't what struck me about Sutton. What struck me was the similarity in the faces, as though a man's father were his brother and his uncle his first cousin. A town of more kin than kith. Sutton, I think, may be the place where those people you see waiting in bus stations for the 1:30 a.m. express are going. In the frayed, cluttery hamlet, everything, people, streets, buildings, seemed to be nearing an end. In one old survivor, Elliot's fountain, cigars, candy, sundries around the window, X-lax thermometer by the tall door, your weight and fate scale there also, and inside a ceramic tile floor in the pattern of a diamondback rattler, I drank a Hamilton Beach chocolate milkshake, the kind served alongside the stainless steel mixing cup. The owner, Hugh Elliott, laid out a 1910 photograph of the drugstore when you could buy a freshly concocted purge or balm or a fountain bromo-seltzer or a dulcimer. Although the pharmaceuticals were gone, you could still get a bromo or a dulcimer. Next to the Texas Instruments 1025 memory calculator, the photograph showed one other change. What had been a spacious room of several bent steel chairs and tables was now top to bottom with merchandise. What had been a place of community was now a stuffed retail outlet. Across the nation, that change was the history of the Soda Fountain Pharmacy. A crisp little lavender and lace lady, wearing her expansion band wristwatch almost to the elbow to keep it in place, sipped a cherry phosphate and pointed out in the photograph the table where her husband, dead these 20 years, had proposed to her. She said, "You won't find me at the grave. Always feel closer to him in here with a phosphate." When I drove out of Sutton, clouds moved in, and the heavy sky sagged with drizzle. It was part of the 60 inches of yearly rainfall here. I fought it a few miles, then gave up and stopped in the old railroad town of Gassaway at the Elk Lunch, formerly the Farmers and Merchants Bank. Hand-painted vertically down the worn Doric granite columns, lunch, beer. I had one of each. Next to me, a man, whose stomach started at his neck and stopped below his groin, said, "Ain't from around here, I see." "How's that?" "Wipe that beer bottle off before you swigged on it." As I ate my hamburger, the fellow explained the best means of taking a catfish. During the long explanation rivaling Isaac Walton's for detail, the man periodically formed a funnel with his index finger and thumb and poured salt into his bottle of Falls City. "Used to could taste the beer in our country," he said. The angling method was this. First, bait a catfish hole with alfalfa and pork fat for 3 weeks. Then, the night before a rain, put a 9-lived Eveready in a sealed mason jar and lower it into the water to hang just in front of the baited hook. "And it works well?" I asked.
"It works sometimes."
When I left, the day had turned to mist, and a red grit came off the highway and glazed the windshield, like looking through a great bloodshot eye. State 4 followed the Elk River, an occluded green thickness that might have been split pea puree. The Elk provided a narrow bench, the only level land, and on it people had built homes, although the river lay between them and the road, and necessitated hundreds of little handmade bridges, many of them suspension footbridges, the emblem of Appalachia. From rock ledges broken open by the highway cut where seeps dripped, hung 5-gallon galvanized buckets to collect the spring water. Again came the feeling I'd had all morning, that somehow I'd made a turn in time, rather than in space, and driven into the 30s. The only things that showed a later decade were the pickup trucks, clean and new, unlike the rattling, broken automobiles. West Virginia 36, a quirk of a road, went into even more remote land. The highway so narrow, my right tires repeatedly dropped off the pavement. Towns, Valley Fork, Wallback, and Left Hand, a school, church, post office, and large hole once the Exxon station. On west lay the Pennzoil country, of small valleys barbed with rusting derricks, the great flywheels turning slowly, inexorably, like the mills of God that grind exceeding fine. I hunched over the steering wheel as if to peer under the clouds, to see beyond. I couldn't shake the sense I was driving in another era. Maybe it was the place, or maybe a slow turning in the mind about how a man cannot entirely disconnect from the past. To try to is the American impulse. But to look at the steady continuance of the past is to watch time get emptied of its bluster, because time bears down less on the continuum than on the components. To be only a nub in the eternal temporary is still to have a chance to see, a chance to pry at the mystery. What is the blue road anyway, but an opportunity to poke at the unseen, and a hoping the unseen will poke back? At Spencer, I turned west, onto U.S. 33. The Appalachians flattened themselves to hills, and Barnsides again gave the Midwest imperative, chew mail pouch. With what was left of day, I crossed the Ohio River into Old Gallipolis. a town of a dozen pronunciations, a gazebo on the square town, settled by 18th-century Frenchmen. Although a priest once placed a curse on Gallipolis, I don't know why, residents today claim it's the loveliest French village on the Ohio. 4. Inquire locally, the road should have been marked. Of the 13,000 miles of highway I'd driven in the last months, Ohio 218 through Gallia County set a standard to measure bad road by, with pavement so rough, I looked forward to sections where the blacktop was gone completely. Along the shoulders lay stripped cars, presumably from drivers who had given up. Yet the sunny county was a fine piece of washed grasses, gleams in hounds' eyes, constructions of spiders, rocks broken and rounded, all those things and fully more. At Ironton, I took the river road down a stretch of power lines, rail lines, water lines, and telephone lines. The birds sleep across the water on the wooded Kentucky bluffs, they say. The old riverbank towns, Franklin Furnace, New Boston, Portsmouth, Friendship, Manchester, Utopia, now found the Ohio more a menace than a means of livelihood, and they had shifted northward to string out along the highway like kinks in a hawser. I had no mind for stopping. God's speed, people once wished the traveler. At Cincinnati, I looped the city fast on the interstate and came to Indiana 56, where corn, tobacco, and blue sailor grew to the knee, and also wild carrot, fleabane, golden Alexander. Apples were coming into a high green, butterflies stitched across the road, and all the way the whip of mowers filled ghost dancing sweetly with the waft of cut grass. Each town had its feed and grain store, each farm its grain bin and corn crib. Rolling, rolling, the land, the road, the truck. I dropped south to New Harmony, Indiana, 12 miles downstream from Grayville, Illinois, where I'd spent that first grim night. New Harmony in June piles up with a sprinkle from golden rain trees, here called gate trees. The town is known for 2 experiments in social engineering, both of which failed. Yet those failures put in motion currents that changed the course of what came after. The abolition of slavery, equal opportunity for women, progressive education, emancipation from poverty. The futuristic village was once even the headquarters for the U.S. Geologic Survey. Rappites from Pennsylvania created the town of Harmony out of bosky Wabash River bottom land in 1814. They grew wheat, vegetables, grapes, apples, and hops. They produced wine, woolens, tinware, shoes, and whiskey. The Rappite Golden Rose trademark, like the Shaker name, became an assurance of quality. A decade later, however, as the struggle of primitive life eased, members began finding more time for reflection. To blunt a growing discontent, the leader, George Rapp, sold the village to Robert Owen and moved the colony back to Pennsylvania, where the people could again start from scratch and live the peace of full occupation. 75 years later, their Shaker-like refusal to have any truck with the future brought about their disappearance. Owen, the British industrialist, utopian, and egalitarian, who worked to create a society free of ignorance and selfishness by eliminating the causes of contest among individuals. His basic tenet was circumstances form character. Renamed the town New Harmony and built a cooperative community that developed into a center for creative social and scientific thought in antebellum America. Yet before the first settler died, egotism and greed did the experiment in. New Harmony survived, but only as a monument to idealism and innovation. Not far from a burial ground of unmarked graves that the old Harmonists share with a millennium of Indians, the mystical Rappites in 1820 planted a circular privet hedge labyrinth, symbolic, a sign said, of the Harmonist concept of the devious and difficult approach to a state of true harmony. After the Rappites, the hedges disappeared. But a generation ago, citizens replanted the maze, its contours strikingly like the Hopi map of emergence. I walked through it to stretch from the long highway. Even though I avoided the shortcut holes broken in the hedges, I still went down the rungs and curves without a single wrong turn. The right way was worn so deeply in the earth as to be unmistakable. But without the errors, wrong turns, and blind alleys, without the doubling back and misdirection and fumbling and chance discoveries, there was not one bit of joy in walking the labyrinth. And worse, knowing the way made traveling it perfectly meaningless. Before I crossed the Wabash, Algonquian for white shining, I filled the gas tank, enough for the last leg. From the station I could see the blue highway curving golden into the western afternoon. I'd make Columbia by nightfall. The circle almost complete, the truck ran the road like the old horse that knows the way. If the circle had come full turn, I hadn't. I can't say over the miles that I had learned what I had wanted to know, because I hadn't known what I wanted to know. But I did learn what I didn't know I wanted to know. The highway before, under, behind. Through the Green River ordinance-enforced towns, past barn lot windmills that said, Air Motor Chicago. On and on. The Mississippi River. Then the oak risings of Missouri. The pump attendant, looking at my license plate when he had filled the tank, asked, Where you coming from, show me? Where I've been. Where else? He said. Lines from a Navajo wind chant. Then he was told, Remember what you have seen, because everything forgotten returns to the circling winds. Afterward. Perhaps it's in our blood. Maybe it's just in our history, but surely it's in the American vein to head out for some other place when home becomes intolerable, or merely even when the distant side of the beyond seems a lure we can't resist. After all, every American has come or is descendant of people who came from another part of the globe. Certain Indian myths notwithstanding, the human species began its journey far from either of the bounding oceans of the Western Hemisphere. Aside from slaves, most of the others first setting foot in America, whether in AD 2000 or 20,000 BC, arrived looking in some way for a life better than what the old world offered. And surely a few came along just to see the territory. As a nation, we are the children of those who tried to solve old problems with a new place. And that may be why the first writing about America comes from explorers, and why other travelers' accounts have flourished for half a millennium. On my shelves at home, I have more than 1,200 narratives of travel through the United States. In the spring of 1978, following not just the urge of several months, but probably also an even deeper inclination set into my veins by grandparents generations gone, I threw over what was then passing for my life, a thing I had botched considerably, in quest of better days. Virtually broke, both in wallet and heart, I struck out for the open road. It took no special courage, except to withstand the entreaties of family and friends not to run away. Leaving was one of the easiest big decisions I've ever made. But once I left home, continuing the journey until it either reached some kind of sensible conclusion or fully played itself out, was another matter. One of the hardest things I've attempted. The trip, and that means Blue Highways too, began 4 years earlier, when I started wondering whether I could cross the United States by auto without ever using a federal highway. Could I go coast to coast on those state and county roads lined out in blue in my old atlas? I sat down one evening and looked for a route. It would not be easy in the far west, but after an hour I'd found a couple of potential courses between the Atlantic and the Pacific, and what's more, I had an idea for a photo story I thought the National Geographic would take an interest in. Across America on the Blue Roads. But circumstances turned sour and didn't permit me to leave, a situation that changed in the frigid winter of 1977. Those events you know from listening to Blue Highways. Even before the long freeze began thawing, I had set my course not simply to cross America but to encircle her, to travel as long as money, gumption, and the capacity to fend off desolation held up. And so on the first day of spring in 1978, I lit out with, instead of a National Geographic story in mind, only the wish for the road to lead me into some kind of new life. one that didn't daily promise me more fruit of my failures. While I went prepared to record events my travel would turn up, and I had hopes of writing a few small stories someone might publish, I primarily wanted to put myself on a new path toward wherever it turned out to lead. I had no idea whether people in rural America would open up to an itinerant, a fellow more lost than otherwise. Wouldn't their suspicions of a bearded stranger stifle any attempt to talk with them about their lives? I had not then heard novelist John Irving's assertion that there are at the heart of things only two plots, two stories. A stranger rides into town, a stranger rides out of town. Without knowing it, I had a chance for both. After a week or so on the road, I began to see that people would indeed share their tables, their homes, their lives. And I slowly realized I might hear enough stories to make a book. By the time I crossed the Appalachians, I'd remembered the image in the proposed Blue Road idea, a term that over the ensuing miles changed into Blue Highways. Partly because those words had for me several levels of meaning, I never imagined then that the phrase would eventually enter the American lexicon as a synonym for back roads. The shape of the journey came from both the Plains Indians' notion that a circle represents the direction of natural forces, and also from John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, a book of some charm but scarcely one of his best, and certainly not his deepest journey, that's Grapes of Wrath. I had not read Jack Kerouac's On the Road, a story with even less travel in it than, say, Huckleberry Finn or Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, so that, despite what some readers have assumed, Kerouac was in no way an influence. It would not be inaccurate to say I was woefully ignorant of travel writing, unless you think of Tom Jones, The Odyssey, The Book of Exodus, Robinson Crusoe, The Peregrinations of Lemuel Gulliver, Gargantua and Pantagruel, and Moby Dick as travel writing. My innocence forced me to reinvent the bow and arrow, or perhaps I should say quill and ink, but that greenness animated my attempts to express what I was hearing and seeing, and it gave me a rookie's passion that would have to carry me through the following 4 years. As I rambled into the countryside, I tried, rather haphazardly at first, to take notes and make pictures. But preeminent always during the 3 months I traveled was the ancient wish to leave an old world and enter a new one. When I returned home about the first day of summer, I immediately went looking for a job, any job, that would underwrite my attempt to turn a bundle of notes into a book. I found work as a drudge in the Boone County Courthouse in Columbia, Missouri, and, purely by chance, managed to write the first few pages of Blue Highways on the 4th of July. I figured I'd finish by Christmas. I didn't, but by then I guessed I could complete it before the next Christmas. After a year in the courthouse, I had put aside enough money to carry me along to the end, or so I thought, and I left the last wills and testaments to write 7 days a week in hopes of finishing before my savings were again gone. I managed to complete 2 unsatisfactory drafts. Then I had to find another job, this one on the loading dock of the Columbia Daily Tribune, work that required me only on weekends but paid a pittance more than $2,000 a year. I must admit here that I have little sympathy for would-be writers who say they could get their novel written if only they could find a grant. When a book really wants out, it will force itself into the light regardless. Writing and researching 8 to 9 hours a day let me reach the third Christmas with yet another draft, but it too was lacking. My family had long before ceased asking me about my efforts because they believed a book gets written in 6 months, a year at most. And many do. It shows. 2 months after I returned from the road, my Cherokee and I amicably parted, and I met someone else. Although we too later went different ways, again amicably, she stood by me during those lean years and helped carry me and the book to the end. Yet one day even she, repeating the phrase I frequently used when talking of my manuscript that still had no definite title, said quietly, "It's too hard on me. Please don't talk any more about a certain forthcoming book. It's not forthcoming." I had just received another rejection slip, and thinking she might be right, I despaired. Was this project one more of my damned ideas going nowhere? By the end of that 4th year, I was beginning to believe publishers. There probably wasn't an audience for such a travelogue. I thought about abandoning my endless rewrites to take on what friends considered real work. Then one morning I read in the New York Times Book Review that Robert Persig, who's about to become famous Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, a challenging and curious philosophical tract built around a travelogue, had received 122 rejections. At that moment, I realized my quitting would not be sensible, but merely weakness. And on the spot, I vowed I would not give up until I had collected 123. Thank Earth, as my atheistic editor Jack Lezebnik says, I didn't have to go that far. Some weeks later, I found an acceptance. And in January of 1983, Blue Highways appeared. By then, I had rewritten it 8 times. And cut it from an 800-page manuscript to 500 pages. The book sold slowly at first, then went on to the New York Times bestseller list, where it stayed off and on for nearly a year. But it was not until spring that I felt secure enough to quit my job on the loading dock. Blue Highways, Roads, and Book remade my life, perhaps even keeping me from appearing in the obituary column too early. Of the many people I'm deeply indebted to, you are one. For a book without a reader is nothing more than bound-up paper. Like the honored courthouse or the invigorating loading dock, you have made it possible for me to keep writing and continue my American travel, explorations that have led me into Prairie Earth and River Horse. As you can see now, I did not at first envision a trilogy, but that's what has happened. A small corpus of journeys, one by wheels, one by foot, the last by boat. What mode is left? The back of an animal? The wings of a machine? No. From here I shall try another genre of writing. I've heard and stumbled into some pretty good stories along the way, which only the cover of fiction can permit me to recount truthfully, or at least fully. Right now I'm jestfully calling that project, using the parlance of some Missouri hill folk, a whole nother story. And so you, whom I can only imagine, even though I think of you often as I write, I thank you for your accompaniment. And I can at last answer 2 questions that may have arisen as you read Blue Highways. What did the people I met along the way, the ones I show in the book, think of it? Well, I was in touch with all of them after publication, except Porfirio Sanchez, whom I could never again find, and Claude Tyler, the barber in Dime Box, Texas, who died before I could finish writing. And I can tell you their responses were virtually one. Although they were hardly enchanted with my depiction of them, I left too much out, emphasized this over that, they liked being a character. To me, from the beginning, they were full of character in all its meanings. And I regret that it's only now I realize I should have told them they were the best professors I ever knew. For they opened the way. The Highway. William Least Heat Moon, Columbia, Missouri, May, 1999. P.S. Your second question, you thought I forgot? I didn't. I never found the banana slug. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Blue Highways, A Journey into America, written by William Least Heat Moon, read by Joe Barrett. Produced by Amber Fairweather. Directed by Graham Malcolm. Recorded by Tommy Herron. Post-production by Chris Howerton. Blue Highways is also available in print and as an e-book from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1982 and 1999 by William Least Heat Moon. Audio production copyright 2013 by Hachette Audio. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.